It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison chef who's a semifinalist for a James Beard Award this year.
It's 1 hour before the restaurant opens, and the small kitchen inside Madison's Ahan is buzzing. Water is boiling, chicken is roasting, and dumplings are frying. Before they even begin taking orders for the lunch rush, the chefs are preparing two big catering orders.
So today it's three Lao egg rolls, three vegetable egg rolls, and three orders of wontons, a couple orders of dumplings, a couple orders of summer rolls.
That's Jamie Huang, co-owner and executive chef of Ahan.
Well, the word Ahan actually just means food, and I just like wanted it to be something cute and playful, and Lao was my first language, so I just thought it'd be like cute and be like, this is our restaurant food.
Ahan began as a food truck, but quick success made it clear that Huang and her partner needed something bigger. They took a leap and opened the brick-and-mortar restaurant in August 2020, the height of the pandemic. At a time when restaurants were folding left and right, Ahan blossomed.
Yeah, a lot of people, like, when they would pick up food, they were really happy, like, that there was something new that they could look forward to or something comforting, you know?
Huang calls Ahan's food comfort food, and at the heart of it is her mother, Manola Huang.
Earliest food memories? Probably her making papaya salad, like a mortar and pestle in the mornings, making sticky rice, like the smell of sticky rice early in the mornings.
And I make papaya too. She said, Mom, I like to eat papaya too. I say,
That's Manola Huang, who grew up in Laos.
And I say, baby, I make a little bit spicy for you. And she like to eat. And I make noodle soup for Mom, I need two hot chili and lamb. And I put lamb and hot chili for Jimmy. Some people young, they don't like to eat hot.
She got her start early.
Uh-huh. And bak chokong Jimmy there.
Oh, yeah, I need one tofu,
Mom. Jamie Huang grew up in kitchens. Her family has owned restaurants across Wisconsin, in places like La Crosse, Beaver Dam, and Madison.
When I do the side job in the kitchen, peel the shrimp, she come to peel with me, too.
My mom said I started becoming interested in peeling shrimp when I was, like, three.
Eventually, Jamie went to culinary school. That led to jobs at some of Madison's hottest restaurants, where she received high-end training. Still, she credits her mom, Manola, for being her biggest culinary inspiration.
I think it wasn't always the path I was going to take, but I've been really happy because, you know, I've been able to, like, take some of her recipes and I'll be able to pass them down, like, her, like, cow soy recipes, like, from her specific city in Laos called Luang Prabang. It's, like, a specific soup to her. And she said her grandma taught her mom and her mom taught her, so... right now, I am making a pram long song with chicken, a red curry udon with chicken, and then I'm also going to put a fried rice on.
Jamie Huang's affection for her mother's recipes, her love of lime, chili, and cilantro, and her belief in using local seasonal produce is getting her recognized by her peers in the industry. She's a semifinalist for a James Beard Award as Emerging Chef. The nomination had an immediate impact on her business.
I mean, obviously it's been really crazy busy. Like, it was busy before, but now it's just, like, next level busy. I think for staff, you know, it's really showed them, you know, all their hard work is really paying off, and I think it's, like, setting the standard and setting them to teach new staff that comes in and showing them to always be proud of their work and, you know, like, anything's possible. Oh, you can take the rice from over here, too. Everything that we've learned from my mom and everything is, like, you know, really coming full circle, and, like, all the hours we put in and stuff, you know, it really just made it feel, like, super, super, like, rewarding, you know.
I'm happy for my daughter to do a good job, you know.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So a lion in the Atlantic caught our eye. Why do birds get all the love? Will someone please think of the urban amphibian? Okay. The common frog is not considered endangered, but ecologists are concerned about habitat threats, and we learn how to help. Call in with your questions about frogs, where you find them, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erin Sauer is here, postdoctoral researcher in biological sciences at the University of Arkansas, studied amphibians in urban ponds around Madison, Wisconsin. Erin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
So you study both amphibians and birds. Birds, though, seem to get the limelight with the conservation groups devoted to their study and identification. Then we have the retail stores devoted to bird lovers and strip malls. Why don't frogs get the same treatment?
Well, I think it's sort of a little unfair for the frogs. You know, birds are so ubiquitous, like you go outside. I'm sitting in my living room right now and I can hear tons of birds singing outside of my window. They're just sort of there all the time. You see them every day. They're right in your face. They're hanging out, chirping outside your window at 5 a.m. So they're just so accessible and so easy for people to connect with and see in their backyard and interact with every day. And frogs, on the other hand, a little more cryptic. They're a little more hidden. They don't necessarily want you to find them. They can also be quite loud, as I'm sure many people have noticed when they're singing at night. Maybe it is a little annoying to some, but they can be quite loud when they're breeding. But they're
What do those ribbits mean?
They are looking to mate. They're out there in the ponds calling for each other, hoping to find a match and lay some eggs in the ponds.
Why should people care about frogs and amphibians?
I mean, there's so many reasons. They're such a treat, I think. Aside from the ecological reasons, which I will get to, I think amphibians provide this invaluable service of being, of just bringing people joy. There's a reason that that frog house TikTok video that I spoke to The Atlantic about went viral, and why amphibians are such a popular theme for adorable internet content. And I think, you know, they come in all these different shapes and sizes. They make all these funny sounds. It's really nice to go out on a walk in the evening and hear them singing, I think. And I think they just bring people happiness. And this complex life cycle that they have, this transformation from an egg to a tadpole to a metamorph to these full-size adults, I think it's so fascinating. And I think most people find it very fascinating. When you're a kid, you learn about this and you get to go out and see tadpoles in your neighborhood parks.
Can you explain a bit more about, yes, and if you could explain a bit more about the ecosystem food chain and, you know, what preys on frogs and then what do frogs eat, where the, you know, kind of just their status.
Yeah. So they eat a lot of pests. They eat agricultural pests, they eat bugs, they eat mosquitoes, they eat mosquito larvae, which nobody likes mosquitoes. So that's a great service that they're providing for us. They're eaten by lots of bigger things. Barred owls really like to eat frogs. But yeah, they get eaten by birds and mammals. They're eaten by fish. So they're definitely wedged right there, sort of in the middle part of the ecosystem where they're eating these insects that we find to be annoying or damaging to agriculture. And at the same time being eaten by these larger, more charismatic, maybe, species like barred owls.
Erin Sauer with us, wildlife ecologist at the University of Arkansas, studied frogs and other amphibians in Wisconsin. Call in with your questions and comments anytime, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A bit more of that boreal chorus frog coming back, courtesy of the Wisconsin Citizen-based Monitoring Network, as we explore why frog habitats are so critical as amphibian populations as a whole, they're in decline. Call in with your questions about frogs in the natural world, 800-642-1234. Aaron Sauer is a postdoctoral researcher in biological sciences at the University of Arkansas and has studied amphibians in Wisconsin. So, Aaron, lay it out for us. How are amphibians doing here in our state, in Wisconsin?
Yeah, globally, amphibians are the most threatened vertebrate taxa on the planet. So more than fish, reptiles, birds, mammals. For the most part, globally and in Wisconsin, habitat destruction is going to be the biggest threat to our local frogs. We have a few species that are declining or threatened, and one endangered species in Wisconsin, the Blanchard's cricket frog. Is the endangered species. And then some salamanders that are rare or of special concern, with mm-hmm. four-toed salamanders. A big problem is just habitat destruction. If there's no habitat, then you can't have a population. It's going to go locally extinct.
What is happening to the habitat? Where is it going? What is it being turned into?
Yeah. So there's agricultural use, there's suburban sprawl as a big one, lawns. So having a new housing development that used to be a prairie and replacing that with the monoculture of mowed grass is certainly not the kind of habitat that amphibians need. And they're just not going to be there. They're not going to thrive in those environments. So this replacement of like native plants with lawns and other non-native or non-natural habitat.
So when the wetlands are filled or those grassy areas are mowed over to make way for developments, where do amphibians go?
Oftentimes nowhere. They're just not there anymore. There's still other populations at other spots that are still available for them, but some species are just excluded from the landscape because they're more sensitive than others to these changes in the habitat.
Are, amphibians more sensitive to environmental pollution? I mean, you mentioned habitat loss, but what about pollution versus other classes of animals like mammals or birds?
Yeah, so habitat destruction encompasses pollution, and amphibians are sort of thought to be these indicators or the canaries in the coal mine because they're so sensitive to pollution. They do lots of things through their skin. They're very sensitive to things like herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, runoff from roads. That can really be a detriment to them since they are spending so much time in the water.
The U.S. Geological Survey had reports of deformed amphibians that have been growing since the 1990s and certainly in past decades. I mean, there was so much conversation about what could have been going on. Is there any knowledge of what causes these deformities?
Yeah, so I think what you're talking about is the frogs with extra legs.
Yeah, and legs and eyes. There were even some double heads. I mean, just lots of major deformities.
Yeah, so the multiple legged ones, that's actually like this interesting interaction between pollution and parasites. In areas where, it's caused by a parasite that's insisting in like where the legs would grow out of a tadpole, and it creates more legs than they should have. And the goal of the parasite is to be eaten to get the frog eaten by the next host in its life cycle. But there was this unusual high prevalence of it in some areas, and that was due to the parasites being able to really be in these like unnaturally large densities because mm-hmm. their snail hosts were overpopulated because of agricultural runoff.
Exploring new research on frogs, other amphibians in urban ecosystems. Aaron Sauer with us studies biological sciences at the University of Arkansas. Your questions along the way here, 800-642-1234. Kenneth in Beloit is here. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello, good morning. Is there control of insects, which is diminished, or bird population? Is that the same, having the same effect on our frogs, the lack of insects, diminishing that population also?
Kenneth, thank you. What can you tell us, Aaron?
It's very likely amphibians need to eat invertebrates. They eat insects both on land and in the water. And there have been these really dramatic declines in insects, particularly in the Midwest, in the Central Plains. And that's going to, you take away their food source, then they're not going to be there. So definitely.
I wonder, are frogs affected by invasives, like invasive species or invasive aquatics?
Absolutely. So one big one out west is sport fish. So a lot of ponds get stocked with non-native fishes mm-hmm. For the purpose of fishing. And those fish will eat the tadpoles and sort of eliminate amphibians from that wetland if there are fish there that are predatory. There's only a couple species that can really deal with there being fish in the environment. At least fish that are large enough to be like major predators, which are the ones that people want to catch. Mm-hmm. So that can be a big problem, is fish getting stocked, non-native fish being stocked in ponds. There's also other amphibians. So bullfrogs are really invasive in the West, and they outcompete some of the native amphibians there. I am originally from Florida, and we have these invasive Cuban tree frogs there that push out some of the native tree frogs in areas where they have invaded. There's also invasive diseases. So chytridiomycosis is a fungal disease that's been spread around the world now. That's caused hundreds of declines and many extinctions of amphibian species globally.
So many threats.
And invasive, yeah.
Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, what question would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So I guess I was wondering, are frogs a keystone species in the state of Wisconsin? And what are some ways to protect those habitats that would help?
A keystone species. Aaron, can you explain?
So a keystone species is a species that's really critical for either engineering habitat or creating some vital service for an ecosystem that allows it to continue to function. I don't know that there's a specific species of amphibian in Wisconsin that would be considered a keystone species, but amphibians, as we talked about before, they do serve really vital ecosystem services by the pressure that they put on the invertebrates in the environment, and then by being food for other organisms.
How do frogs handle cold winters, or how do they avoid freezing and know when it's time to come out for spring?
So frogs and other amphibians in Wisconsin survive the winter in a variety of really interesting ways. Wood frogs are probably the coolest. So they freeze over. They turn into little frog icicles and just freeze up and stay frozen for the winter. Some hang out in the non-frozen parts of running water, like in streams. Some are underneath the ice. And then there's some like tiger salamanders that actually burrow underground and hang out underground all winter and then emerge in the springtime.
So resourceful. I'm going to pause right here. Call in with your questions and comments about frogs and other amphibians, 800-642-1234. We're with Aaron Sauer, wildlife ecologist at the University of Arkansas, studied amphibians in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the challenges up against frogs and other amphibians in Wisconsin. More famous for their croaking and jumping, we learn what their populations say about the health of our state's ecosystems. Call in with your questions, your thoughts about frogs, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron Sauer is a wildlife ecologist at the University of Arkansas who has studied frogs in Wisconsin. Aaron, Tom from Milwaukee called in and wants to know if the low snowfall is impacting the habitat for frogs, like around ponds.
Potentially, yeah. So that snowfall builds up in the winter and creates this habitat underneath it called the synovium, where lots of organisms hang out during the winter because it stays, you know, warmer and sort of buffered from the external air temperature. And when that habitat is reduced or goes through these more frequent thaws during the winter than it normally would, where it's thawed down to the ground and back over and over again, it can freeze up the soil. And a lot, as I mentioned before, there are quite a few species that burrow underground. And if the snow's not there to sort of buffer the soil from freezing, then they could potentially have problems while they're overwintering.
Tom also wants to know if you can talk a bit about spring peepers. What is unique about this type of frog?
Yeah, spring peepers, they come out to breed pretty early. That's why they're called spring peepers. They're sort of like first sign of spring.
The harbinger.
Along with the boreal chorus frogs, they sort of come out really early and start calling, often while there's still snow on the ground. They're probably calling right now in Wisconsin. There's sort of this... They're really common all over the eastern U.S. We have them here in Arkansas. It's one of the first species that we hear too coming out in the early spring, late winter. And it's such a nice sign of spring. They're tiny, tiny frogs. They're really hard to find, to see, but they're very, very, very loud. They're very easy to hear. They can be just exceptionally loud.
What are unusual frog or amphibian species that you've seen discovered in Wisconsin? What have you encountered in our part of the states?
Yeah. My favorite thing that I have seen in Wisconsin are the eastern tiger salamanders. They're not rare necessarily, but they can be hard to actually see. So early in the spring, once there's a night where it's warm enough, where it's above freezing and we get a little bit of rain, they all come out in mass out from their underground burrows and migrate to the pond or the lake or whatever water body they're going to hang out in during the breeding season. And if you time it just right and go to the right place, you can see, you know, tons of them crossing the road, walking over to their ponds, and they're huge. They're like...
Yeah, what do they look like?
They're salamanders, so they're long, they have tiny little legs. They're super thick, like a sausage. They have like this very thick body and these kind of like a navy blue color with yellow spots on them. Hmm. They're really beautiful. And they're quite large. They're bigger than the palm of your hand in length by
Wow.
quite a few inches. And they just kind of waddle on over from their upland wintering grounds into the ponds. And I was able to see that big migration happen near Madison one time in Wisconsin. And that was a really awesome experience.
I suppose you didn't see any road signs helping, making sure drivers heel, you know, yield to their crossing.
I did not, but this location where they were is known locally by people who care about tiger salamanders, and there are people who go out and try to like shepherd them
wow.
across the street to make sure that they aren't crushed by cars. But that road mortality is actually a really big problem in the springtime for these species that sort of come out in mass and migrate to their ponds. Toads do this too. You'll see like hundreds of toads come out in one night and migrate to the ponds, which is really cool to see. But they often cross the road to do that and get run over. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources actually has a form on their website for reporting road mortalities of amphibians that data allows them to find which roads are the ones where mortalities are happening most, and then they can try to mitigate those road mortalities.
Oh, so there are efforts underway there. Yeah. So you studied almost 100 ponds in the Madison area to see which ones favored amphibians and which ones didn't. Can you give us some takeaways? What did you find?
Yeah. So they like complex habitat. They have complex habitat needs. They have these terrestrial needs, these aquatic needs, and they need ponds that have both. They need riparian areas, so vegetation that's around the pond, not just ponds that are mowed all the way up to the edge. They need places to hang out. Some species, like tree frogs, need trees, oddly enough, to hang out in. So different types of species need different types of things. But there's tree frogs and toads. They need more of these ponds that are woody, that have like trees around them and shade. Where our bigger, like bullfrogs and green frogs, need more open areas.
And you found a bit of good news about golf courses, I understand.
Yeah, there's actually quite a variety in how golf course ponds are landscaped, I guess. So some are incredible. There's one in town that had tiger salamanders in the ponds, which was amazing. And that golf course probably had the best landscaping. So they had nice riparian buffer areas around their ponds. They had trees interspersed, lots of like connectivity between the different ponds on the golf course. But others, I would go and the pond would just be like a concrete bottom.
Oh,
and
dear.
And somebody like a groundskeeper would ask how what they could do to kill every single thing in the pond. And that's obviously not going to be great. So it's definitely, there's definitely huge impacts of just, you know, the management that's managing the pond or the golf courses. And they can be these great oases in these urban areas for amphibians if they're landscaped to look like, to emulate the natural habitat. But if they're landscaped to be mowed all the way up and they get chemical shocked once a year, then you're not going to have any frogs there.
Aaron Sauer with us studies biological sciences at the University of Arkansas, exploring new research of frogs, other amphibians, and urban ecosystems, especially here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jane is here from Suamico. Jane, hi.
Hi, I have a question for your guest. We have a big pond, and we used to have toads and green frogs where it would sound like a freight train. They were so loud as they were going through their mating season. And we've planted bluegills and perch in the pond, and I've witnessed how the bluegills will, like, slurp up the strings of eggs laid by some of the frogs and things, and I wondered if she could comment. We don't have nearly as many anymore, and I'm wondering if we're kind of decimating the frog and toad population because of the fish we planted in the pond.
Erin?
Yeah, unfortunately, probably. Bluegill and other sunfish are super voracious predators, and they're really great at eating up egg masses and eating up the tadpoles and eating the adult frogs. So when you add predatory fish to ponds, you're likely gonna either completely, like eventually completely get rid of the amphibians that are in that pond, or cause major declines in the numbers that were in there previously.
Is there anything that Jane could do to make amends or to remedy the situation?
Yeah, so the best way, and this is not easy to do, depending on what kind of pond you have, but the best way is to just get rid of the fish. And the best way to do that is to drain the pond and just dry it out, which happens normally in a lot of ponds. So a lot of amphibians like these ephemeral wetlands, which just means that they're temporary. So they dry once a year, sort of at the end of the summer, in the fall usually. That drying, it keeps fish out. They really like those habitats that are fish free. So you could drain your pond towards the end of the summer.
Kind of start from scratch.
Get rid of the fish, yeah. Well, it's not really starting from scratch. A lot of the invertebrates and things that are there will still be there.
Hmm.
They're used to that. That's sort of the way that a lot of...
That's a natural cycle.
Species, yeah, have adapted. They're used to regular drying.
All right. Well, Jane, thank you so much for calling in. Good luck on the future of the pond. I want to turn to, you mentioned earlier, this viral TikTok video showing how a man in Australia noticed a frog living on his fence. And so he created a house for the frog, and which became more and more elaborate to include a pond and plants and a safe room to escape threats. Should people build shelters in their yards to help amphibians?
Absolutely. First off, it's super fun, but if there is nowhere for them to hang out, they're not going to be there at all. So creating any habitat in your yard is going to be a positive thing if they're not there previously. And you can create these sort of structures. So some frogs, like tree frogs, really like to hide out in like little tiny spaces. And one thing they really like is PVC pipes. When I was in Florida, I used to collect Cuban tree frogs, and we would just put PVC pipes out in wetlands and just walk back out to the pipes, and there would be like five frogs in them. They just really like it. It like emulates the kind of spaces that they would normally hide in. So they really like hanging out in those. If you look up toad houses, they're just like broken pots that people flip upside down, and toads like to hang out in them during the day. A lot of amphibians are nocturnal, so they're just looking for safe, dark places to hang out during the day. So you can put these little structures in that sort of emulate their natural habitat, and they'll hang out in them.
They'll eventually find them. University of Arkansas wildlife ecologist Erin Sauer bringing us closer to the lives of frogs here in Wisconsin. Call in with your questions and comments about amphibians in our state and beyond. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you can be here as we talk about frogs and toads that make up the largest group of amphibians, learning about their habitat challenges, what it means for biodiversity in Wisconsin. Join in, call with your questions, your thoughts about frogs, what you've seen of them in your area, past and present, 800-642-1234. Erin Sauer is a postdoctoral researcher in biological sciences at the University of Arkansas and stays with us. Lisa now in Whitefish Bay. Lisa, what would you like to bring up?
Hi. This brought back memories of when I was growing up in Oconomowoc in the 60s. And in the early 60s, the town was only about 6,000 people. And our backyard even bumped up to woods and farmland and stuff. And in Lake LaBelle, which is a lake, not a pond there, we would catch mud puppies along with minnows. And we had tree frogs on the elm tree in our yard. And by the end of the 60s, we didn't see any of that anymore. And the town had rapidly developed. The farms started disappearing and things. But also, I know there was a lot of spraying of DDT going on. And I'm wondering if those were some of the factors that, you know, killed off those little creatures.
Oh, Lisa, thank you so much. Aaron, what about the past and pesticides, soil toxins that could affect the lives of frogs now?
Yeah, so there are lots of different ways that pesticides can affect amphibian populations. Some of that is through these sort of trophic level effects. And what I mean by that is when things like herbicides might impact the amount of vegetation that's in the water, which might decrease the number of bugs and affect amphibians, or insecticides. If the amphibians are dependent on the insects that are in the water, you know, insecticides like DDT, those can have direct impacts if they're toxic to the amphibians, but they can also kill off their food source, which is going to be another problem for them. So there's lots of these sort of direct and then indirect effects of pesticides on amphibians. And it's best generally if you have the option to not use them.
There's been a lot more focus, it seems, on how to control runoff, cropland runoff, which I would imagine also impacts amphibians. I wonder how long it takes for populations to bounce back once you do have more recovery of wetlands and buffers and just better knowledge of how to, how to cross over between cropland and wetland areas.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as far as how some species can be really resilient, and bounce back fairly quickly through wetland mitigation. So restoring wetlands to their natural states is really beneficial, and some species recover right away. Others that have smaller populations, they might not be able to colonize or like move into those new habitats because they're so sort of decimated all around that there just aren't individuals to migrate into those new areas. So it's really sort of a mix. The rare species are rare for a reason. They're going to have a harder time making it back mm-hmm. into those new areas than the more common ones, which are going to be abundant in smaller populations around the new area. But any restoration is good.
Restoration, good. Yes. Some people might want to turn a wild frog they found into a pet. Can you give us some details there? Can we give amphibians too much love?
Yeah. Generally, it's best to let wild animals remain wild. Collecting tadpoles can seem really fun, but they are very challenging to raise. They have a lot of really specific needs with water chemistry and food, and they can be really hard to take care of, harder than you might think. So you might just end up killing them all if you try to collect them and keep them. Frogs can be really good pets, but I would recommend getting them from a pet store or from someone who's legally allowed to sell them. There's a couple of species in Wisconsin which I think residents are allowed to collect, but I think you need a permit. So it's probably not legal to go out mm-hmm. and collect frogs and keep mm-hmm. them as pets without permissions from the DNR. So you also want to avoid violating wildlife regulations in the state.
Do you have a pet frog?
I used to. I used to have a pet Cuban tree frog which is an invasive in Florida that I just caught on my front porch one day. But they're invasive. So generally when you catch them, it's actually illegal to put them back if you catch one.
Oh.
But I kept it in like a big aquarium or terrarium that had like some nice plants and stuff growing in it. It was a pretty good pet.
That was one lucky frog. So how could government leaders or the DNR take steps that would help nurture frogs? What more could we do?
I think, so the DNR has plans for wetlands and for monitoring of species that are of concern. As individuals, there's a lot of ways to volunteer. So there's the frog and toad surveys that go on that are organized by the DNR and by the USGS that allow us to monitor populations and population trends over time. And that information is really important for understanding like where they're most at risk. And it's often not feasible to try to, you know, fix all of the habitat everywhere. That's just not something that's possible. But when you have information on where animals are and where they're declining, you can target those areas specifically. And that's a much better use of resources. So that's sort of the idea with having these surveys, which anyone can volunteer to help out with, where you go out at night and listen to frog calls and say which frogs are there. Yeah.
Aaron, what mysteries about amphibians are scientists still trying to solve and trying to figure out?
Oh, there's always things that we don't know. I mean, there's new species of frogs that are, and amphibians that are found all the time. One of the big places that are a big focus of research for amphibians right now are focused on disease and chytridiomycosis and how we can control and bring back species and populations that have gone extinct. Or are in really severe threatened states because of this parasite. So that's a big area of research that we're trying to work on and figure out how we can deal with this major threat to biodiversity.
It's interesting that new species are found and yet so many have gone extinct. It means that there is a lot of mystery out there.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, Aaron, yes, it is a big world. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it and for sharing your research.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Aaron Sauer is a postdoctoral researcher in biological sciences at the University of Arkansas, studying urban frog life, especially in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.